This is another iRaw podcast.
So in the feminization of Mother India, it was both the woman and the mother cow.
Welcome back to The Animal Turn, everyone. This is another bonus episode. This time it gives me great pleasure to say I will be speaking to Yamini Narayanan again. For those of you who have been listeners of the podcast for some time, I spoke to Yamini in, I think it was season 3, where we were focusing in on animals in the urban and we spoke about informality. Yamini is just one of these exceptional scholars who seems to really just capture things and say things with such force and power that you can't look away. I'm gushing just introducing her. I really enjoyed reading this book so much. Mother Cow, Mother India is a phenomenal piece of scholarship, and it really does show you what is possible with ethnographic research. Let me tell you a little bit about Yamini before we go any further. So Yamini Narayanan is an associate professor of international and community development at Deakin University in Melbourne. Her new book, which we'll be talking about today, Mother Cow, Mother India, from Stanford University Press, explores the nexus between dairying and right-wing authoritarianism that underpins India's cow protection politics. Her work is supported by 2 Australian Research Council grants, and she is currently researching animals in the enforced labor of India's brick kilns, exploring the anti-anthropocentric politics of poverty. She's a lifelong fellow of the Oxford Centre for Animal Ethics, an honour that is only conferred through nomination or invitation. Now, we jump straight into the conversation today. You can tell that I'm very excited, and Yamini and I just have a way of kind of chatting, so we get straight into it without much pretense. So I'm just going to give you a little bit of a backdrop with regards to the book. So in the book, Yamini does critical animal ethnography, and she spends a great deal of time in India observing cows and observing the relationships that they have in India. And this includes everything from cows roaming streets to cows in sanctuaries to cows in dairies. She thinks about how cows have been transported, the ways in which they're able to relate to one another. And in the conversation today, we try to center our conversation on the idea of mother and how the many ways in which, you know, cows are kind of used with the idea of mother. So what does it mean to be a mother? Yamini does a really skilled job of contrasting the kind of ideologies of motherhood with the materiality of being a cow mother in India. Her work is really exceptional, and if you're looking for a book that you just won't be able to put down, I think it's this one. So definitely go check it out, Mother Cow, Mother India, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Not only is it a privilege to be speaking about your book today, but it's an honor to have you back on the show. You're the first guest ever in the podcast's history to be on twice. So put that on your CV.
I am excited and honored, Claudia, because I have actually been really impressed at how quickly and how rapidly you have taken an animal turn to the next level. It's actually right up there. Given it's still young, it's right up there as one of the most prominent animal studies podcasts, and you have an exceptional range of guests. You have introduced me to whole new fields of thinking and knowledge just from your podcast. So thank you in turn, because you've done an amazing job of really establishing yourself and establishing your podcast as a valuable knowledge bank.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, I'm looking forward to, once the PhD is done and dusted, to see what else I can do with the Animal Turn. But yeah, so in today's episode, this is going to be a bonus episode, and we're going to focus on your book. But I wanted to center the conversation around the word mother. So your book is called Mother Cow, Mother India. And like I said a moment ago, it's absolutely exceptional. And we'll get into a whole bunch of different components about it. It's rich, it's detailed, it's heartbreaking, and it's personal. You put a lot of yourself into this book. So before we get into kind of talking about mother, maybe we can start with the beginning. What made you want to write this book?
Oh, thanks for that question, Claudia, because when I ask a lot of animal studies scholars about, you know, how they got into their respective fields and respective pursuits, one of the common answers I always get is that they have always had some sort of a relationship with animals, and they've grown up with animals, or, you know, they have had intimate, you know, relationships of kinship, family, care, etc. And they'd also always been taught to honor and respect animals. Now, none of that was necessarily true of me. And that is why my own story actually gives me a lot of hope about how it's possible to change minds, because we grew up with a lack of awareness of animals. I wouldn't say that we were taught to be exploitative or cruel or harmful in any intentional way, but we certainly had no awareness of animals growing up. I think like a lot of human beings, we just sort of lived in our very anthropocentric, human-centric worlds. And insofar as animals invaded our worlds at all or intruded or made their presence known, those are better words, they were more in terms of stories or cute incidents or rarely violence as well, because we also lived in very mainstream urban worlds where you are actually secluded from the violence that is normative for animals. So the way that I got into this research was in 2014. I was starting a new research project, and that was around when the BJP, the Bharatiya Janata Party, that's the Indian People's Party, came to power in India. For the first time in India's history as a post-colonial independent nation, the Hindu right finally asserted itself at the center in an exceptionally prominent way. And Narendra Modi came to power as the Prime Minister of India. And right around simultaneously at the same time, a specific form of othering of Muslims started, and this time it involved an animal. It involved the cow, right? So Muslims who were accused of slaughtering cows or butchering cows or transporting cows to slaughterhouses started to be lynched, killed. Women were raped. So there were all sorts of atrocities being perpetrated against them using the cow, weaponizing the cow. So I started to get really interested in what was actually going on, because and I was trained as a journalist. So for me, it was always very clear that I had to get all sides of the story. And one of the missing stories for me was always what the animal activists had to say. It would take me even longer to train my focus directly on the animals. It was still, my research was still very human-centric to start with. And when I wanted to hear what the animal activists had to say. Even so, it wasn't very clear, because when I did start to contact animal activists, they operate a little bit differently to the cow vigilantes who were claiming to protect cows from the Muslim butchers, right? So they operate differently because they have an investment in all types of animal well-being and welfare, etc. So I was exposed instantaneously to a whole world of animal atrocities, starting with pigs and snakes and monkeys and dogs and cats. Like my world exploded. I had no idea. And I started to think, not in my name. Like I had no idea. I had no idea that it caused so much suffering, so much heartache, so much terror, so much fear, so much of every type of suffering, hunger, you name it, right? And I just thought, not in my name. And I actually went directly back to my activist friend, who I actually talk about in my book, Pradeep, and I asked him, what should I do? And he said, focus on the cows, just because the cow is so hyper-political at the moment. He says, we as activists also don't know what to make sense of it. So I started to focus on the cow. And it's actually really interesting, because by caste, I'm of the Brahmin caste. And this caste is actually associated traditionally with cow protectionism and implicitly by engaging in othering practices. So in a sense, I was actually placing myself in a very stereotypical position of writing a book on cow protection as a Brahmin woman. So I had to tread this landscape very carefully so that I didn't sort of come across as reinforcing any of those stereotypes that I absolutely reject of oppression.
Well, I mean, I think your book does exactly that. I think your book seems to be a resistance to the simple story, right? There is no simple story throughout your book, but maybe we can just take a step or two back a little bit here. So firstly, you're speaking about cow protectionism and you're speaking about animal rights. And to people who are not really alert to Indian politics and how kind of central cows are to Indian politics, they might not really understand what the difference is here. And something quite you do really early on in your book is you say, well, there is a key difference between cow protectionism and what might be called animal activists, because perhaps cow protectionists would frame themselves as being a form of animal activist, but that's not really what you say. You say that there's a key difference between these two groups of people.
That's right. That's right. And thanks for drawing attention to this very crucial difference. So again, to step back a little bit, as you suggest, this actually goes back to India's colonial time and then the independence movement that sort of mobilized around the colonial time. There was a very strong anxiety about what happens once the British leave. What sort of country does India become? Does it become a Hindu state? Does it become a Muslim state? Or does it become a secular state? Right? And there was a really strong resistance movement to this idea of secularism from both Hindu, from both the Hindu right and the Muslim right. So there was a very strong movement for the creation of two states, which one would be a Hindu state and one would be a Muslim state, which eventually became Pakistan, and later Pakistan split into Pakistan and Bangladesh. But there was also an even stronger secular movement in India led by the Congress Party, which was very explicitly and intentionally secular. And they said they always wanted India to be a secular state, which the Hindu right really rejected from the start, because they said that if Pakistan gets to be its own Muslim state, India by rights should be a Hindu state, right? And they lost that battle at the time of independence, but they have never stopped trying. And they have finally come to power in India. They have been very patient. They have waited some 75 years post-independence, and they have now finally come to power. Now, as a way of mobilizing for a Hindu state, they took a number of approaches. One of the approaches that they took was the feminization of the Hindu state. That feminization took two parts again. One was, of course, the Mother India as a woman, as a Hindu woman specifically, right? The other was Mother India as cow, as a lactating cow, okay? Now, the cow is not more unique in theological or Hinduism than other animals. If you go back to pure theological Hinduism, Hinduism as a religion actually regards all living, all life as sacred. So we even have a tradition of worshipping trees. You know, we have a sacred grove tradition, a sacred forest tradition. So technically speaking, all animals and plant life and tree life in India are sacred, right? Rats are sacred. We have a tradition of worshipping rats in certain parts of India. There are certain castes in Rajasthan, for example, that have a strong tradition of worshipping rats. So there's a whole number of animals that are worshipped in Hinduism. Cow per se is not unique in the theological landscape. But in the political landscape, the cow emerges as the meta animal, because the cow is twinned with Brahmins in the caste structure. Now, in the Hindu caste imagination, animals are also born into caste. It's not just human beings, but animals are also born into caste. Okay? So in race, for example, we dehumanize using the animal to dehumanize human beings. In caste, animals and human beings are very intricately interconnected. Brahmins and cows are intricately interconnected. Right? So upper caste, and caste is, of course, a hierarchical system. So one of the ways in which we always reinforce hierarchies is through the use of symbols. The cow sort of lends herself as such a symbol, right? And in the creation of a Hindu state, it wasn't going to be a low-caste Hindu state, obviously, low-caste in quotes. It wasn't going to be a low-caste Hindu state or an untouchable caste Hindu state in quotes. It was obviously going to be an upper-caste Hindu state. So it made sense, therefore, to mobilize the cow as a symbol of Mother India as well. So in the feminization of Mother India, it was both the woman and the mother cow, right? Now, how do you other? Because we all know that nationalism per se is a project of inclusion and exclusion. Nationalism doesn't work if you don't exclude, right? So how do you exclude using these symbols of Mother India as female in terms of the human or the cow? They, you know, Indian feminist sociologists for a long time have talked about how the Muslim is framed as rapist, right? So rapist of Hindu women, therefore implicitly rapist of Mother India. And you extend that to cows, the Muslim becomes a cow slaughterer. And therefore also violating Mother India.
Okay, so you've got the emergence, if I'm following everything correctly, you've got the emergence of a Hindu state here, and cows are mobilized in order to propel the divisions between different caste systems. So because cows are associated and not naturally so, because they're kind of politically mobilized to function as part of the Hindu state, they help to kind of create the divisions not only between different castes, but also between different animals. So some animals kind of get revered more than others, but some castes get revered more than others. And the caste system's really quite complicated. I think for folks that are outside of India, I was quite startled when reading your book, just how intense and visceral, you know, the caste system is. You know, you have several examples in the book of people being from, a Dalit caste is one of the lower caste. You've got Muslim folks who are in India as well. And how if you're part of a Dalit caste and you encounter a Brahmin who is an upper caste member, you could be asked to sit on the floor. You could be treated really poorly just because you've been born into a different caste system.
Exactly, exactly. It's a very dehumanizing landscape. It's a dehumanizing, abjecting, humiliating landscape. Its oppressions are much more entrenched than the oppressions of race, which are terrible enough, right? So because with the oppressions of caste, it is read as a sociobiological truth. It's in the biology. If you're lower caste, it's in the biology that you're a certain way. So it's read as a sociobiological truth. So that makes it even more entrenched as an oppression mechanism. And also as an elevation mechanism, right? So Brahmins are inherently superior because it's in our biology.
So it's like an essentializing move. But what's quite interesting is it also seems to be attached to different kind of labors, right? So if you're born into a specific caste, you tend to be found doing particular types of labor. And this has also led to some people finding themselves more affiliated with the dairy industry versus other people being more affiliated with slaughter and beef industries, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You read that correctly. So the dairy production continuum is a vast continuum. From, let's say, simplistically putting it, from breeding all the way to slaughter. We know that there is a forelife and afterlife. Katie Gillespie's work talks a lot about the afterlife of dairying. But let's put it simply in terms of breeding to slaughter, right? Just that continuum. Even just that continuum, in addition to the continuum beyond and before, is a very vast, comprises of a very vast professional expertise. So when I went to the breeding farms, for example, you go to a semen bovine a frozen semen farm, that is full of highly white-collar educated professionals because they have to be trained in genetic engineering. They have to have professional expertise in genetic engineering. You have to be of a highly dominant, privileged caste in order to be able to access that kind of education, in order to be able to access that kind of research funding. We all know research funding underpins all of this sort of knowledge production and how expensive it can be. And, you know, the kind of equipment that genetic science requires. And bovine reproductive genetic science is actually one of the most researched aspects of almost all animal production, right? So you have very privileged cohorts of people, caste cohorts of people who are composing this particular section of the breeding end. And then you go further down and then you have the dairy farmers. Now the dairy farmers will comprise usually the middle castes, a lot of the middle castes, right? Like the Patels of Gujarat, they're all of the middle caste, so they'll comprise all of that. They're still higher because the key distinction is not between the upper and the middle. The key distinction really is at the interface of the untouched, so-called the former untouchable caste and everybody else. Because untouchability is a very crucial distinction, right? That is actually... It's a criminal offense in India under the Indian Constitution to practice untouchability. It's seen as a human rights violation. So that is where the most oppressive interface of caste actually occurs, is between the caste deemed untouchable and everybody else. So the middle caste and the upper caste, there's really a lot of interface, which is not necessarily carrying the same kind of violence that it does at this end. So you have the middle caste who are engaged in dairy production. And here as well, there's a lot of privilege because milk by itself is not as valuable as once you start adding value to it, which means, you know, once you start processing the milk into cheese and ice cream and all of these value-added products. Again, you need a lot of capital, a lot of professional expertise. So again, this branches off into a lot of professional and caste-based diversity, which are all privileged. But then once you move the animal herself down the production continuum into transporting for slaughter, which is itself a very key aspect of production. Like Dinesh Vadivel's work talks about how transportation is significant because, you know, you have to move the animal to add value to the animal body. But in India, transportation takes on an extra meaning because we are technically not supposed to be transporting cows to slaughter. That doesn't happen, supposedly, in India. So what happens in India is that goes underground. Now, who is going to be working underground? Not the privileged groups of people. People who are going to be working underground and doing exceptionally risky labor, because you can imagine that transporting cows to slaughter is one of the most risky things you can do in India, in the current climate, where you have a Hindu right government in power at the moment. They have been in power for the last almost 10 years and likely to come back again, right? So transporting cows in India takes an exceptionally charged a charged tone. So, and then also, of course, butchering the cows itself, right? So these activities with relation to cows specifically have to happen underground. So, but even if it happened legally in an authorized manner, as it does in most other countries, who works at the slaughter end of production? It is always the marginalized people. Like that was, you know, all over Tim Petcherat's work, for example. It is always the undocumented workers, the vulnerable workers, the marginalized workers. It's always the marginalized labor that are racially, caste-wise, etc., that are at the slaughter end of production. And in India, it is exceptionally so just because it is associated with such extraordinary risks, right?
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned at the beginning, if you get affiliated or associated with the slaughter of cows, you can face really severe, like lynchings and killings for being associated with cow slaughter. And you make a really powerful point in your book about how we need to start speaking about human rights issues together with animal rights issues. And I hope we'll manage to get to that. But maybe we can now start switching a little bit to talking about mother. So you said there a moment ago that cows are kind of used as this national symbol, the symbol of motherhood, right? Like the nation mother. I remember reading about this when thinking about South Africa, how women are mobilized to be like mothers of a nation, right? The Afrikaner nationhood. But when you start to talk about an animal being the mother of a nation, it seems quite different and strange. But then again, cows are also actually mothers. And I think that this is something you do quite well, is to show how variable the idea of what a mother is in India. Like on the one hand, you've got this national kind of rhetoric being used to mobilize and create like an idea of what India should be. But on the other hand, you've got the very material reality of what it means to be a bovine mother in India.
Yes. Yes. So I was trying to unravel. You read that so perfectly, so beautifully. I was trying to unravel the different facets of being a mother, because on the surface of it, it sounds nice to say that we regard the cow as we regard our mother, right? Because the mother is one of the most treasured relationships in intra-human relationships, right? The mother was probably one of the most important figureheads in intra-human relationships. So it actually sounds like a good thing. It sounds like there can be no harm. And on the contrary, there's a profound amount of respect, love, reverence, veneration accorded to a farmed animal. It's not just, we are well past talking about humane at this point, and we're talking about venerating a being in this way. But at the same time, this idea of labeling a being as mother beyond the responsibilities and attachments that might arise between a mother and her child, whether, you know, biological or adopted. I mean, of course, even within these realms, the use of motherhood can be very diverse. But let's simplify here, let's just talk about the relationship between the mother and her specific child. To extend beyond that and to project a motherhood on women, for example, in some sort of a political way, is actually, feminists have talked about how non-innocent and how purposively intentional and exploitative this is. So Indian feminists have said, for example, they have gone so far as to say that the labeling of women, in the case of humans, women as mothers or as wives, at least that's one label that's been spared to cows, right? But the labeling of women as mothers or wives, like the mother of the, you know, we have a cultural responsibility of being mothers of mothers of the nation, passing on cultural values of Hinduism and safeguarding the Hindu nation through our mothering responsibilities. They actually say that labeling the burden that women have had to bear as being objectified as mothers, they actually say it's one of the most significant reasons for the backward status of women in India more generally. And we're talking about the backward, we're talking about health benchmarks, education, literacy, employment, wages. In just about every realm of the Human Development Index, women in India fall amongst some of the most low ranks of enjoying any of these sorts of basic human rights, human development indexes, right? And they say that one of the reasons is this sort of labeling of women as mother, which actually ends up controlling them, cornering them, and imposing upon them a particular identity from which they cannot break out of, right?
what's all around you, almost everywhere you look, and makes your life better? Birds. Learn all about these beautiful creatures in this wonderful new podcast called Birds of a Feather Talk Together. Two experts guide two newbies on their journey to learn more. Mallard ducks, ivory-billed woodpeckers, Hawaiian honeycreepers, blue jays, cardinals, sandhill cranes, and more. Each week we discuss a different bird and walk away with a better understanding of the birds all around us. Oh, and we have a ton of fun doing it. Listen now. You're going to like learning about these birds. I guarantee it.
So you're not speaking here about women who are mothers as in nursing their children. You're speaking here about how the idea of motherhood is mobilized to make women take on particular types of responsibility for passing along national identities or ideas, or and that requires work and labor, but also I suppose you can't be in specific places or spaces. That if you are mothering, you're restrained in particular ways. So am I correct here? So you're not speaking necessarily about the bond between a mother and a child. You're speaking here about the kind of ideas that come with passing along something.
Absolutely, precisely. I'm actually separating the bond between a mother and child from this sort of political objectification of women as mothers, right? Because in the case of cows, and I think the case of cows exemplifies this, the political objectification of a being as mother actually completely serves to sever or violate the original bond between the mother and her child. Right? So Martha Nussbaum talks about objectification, right? She talks about objectification and she outlines, I think, seven ways in which objectification is inherently violent. She talks about objectification as a process that is inherently violent. And she notes just one exception to this, which can make it not violent, right? She says, objectification is not violent when there is informed consent. If I am allowing myself to be objectified based on informed consent, then it is not necessarily violent. Then that's the one exception to objectification being violent. Animals cannot give up informed consent. Right? So all forms of objectification of animals are violent. And one of the central arguments of my book is that the sacralization of animals is also a form of objectification that is therefore inherently violent. Whether it's a sacralization as a goddess, sacralization as just inherently sacred, or one of the most harmful forms of objectification is the imposition of the motherhood mantle on a being in political frame.
I thought this was really so powerful. The idea of how being deemed sacred or godlike, you know, we might think, I mean, so as you know, I do work on cows as well. And almost invariably, whenever I speak about cows in North America and I talk about some of the violences and objectification, people always bring up India, because India sits in a, when it comes to cows, not only in Indian imaginaries, but in global imaginaries, India has a very unique space, right? So people who know very little about India or Indian politics, cows are front and center, even outside of India, as being a place where somehow India is unique. And then, you know, people will mobilize it even outside, beyond the border, saying, but, you know, cows are sacred in India. And then you read your book and you say, and I was like, wow, well, being sacred really doesn't do the cows any favors in India, because it just seems as though if you are sacred, you have a whole bunch of things done to you, as you say, that you can't necessarily give any sort of consent for. So you paint this really incredible picture of kind of milk being poured over statues in this kind of reverence, while at the same time, you've got a cow tied up with her calf that she can't get near to. And it was just an incredible juxtaposition of the material desire of the cow to be with her calf versus the idea of her as a sacred cow and how much that divorces her from what she might want.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. The idea of sacred as being a celebratory or even a liberatory ethic is deeply, deeply unfounded. In the case of, we must remember that not too long ago, children were also worshipped in India, right? And in Hindu cultures. So child worship was common. In fact, child worship is still common in a lot of communities or in a lot of spaces and geographies. We don't necessarily come to know about it because child worship would actually now be considered a child rights abuse it would be considered child abuse to worship a child. But that being said, I remember not long ago, 2017, I was in Kathmandu for, again, an animal studies conference. And one of, you know, when attached to conferences, you have a lot of, there's a lot of tourist literature. And, you know, one of the tourist literatures that we saw was actually of a temple where a girl child was being worshipped. And we were actually horrified. We were shocked. We were so horrified. Of course, none of us went. We weren't going to participate in that. But we were actually really horrified because we had never heard of that done so openly in India. That's what I'm saying. It's not to say that it doesn't exist. It just is not so open, as a lot of these things are not. But it would be considered a major child abuse, a major form of child abuse to worship a child. Because what happens? What happens when you worship a child, when you worship a woman, when you worship an animal, is that you are imposing a particular identity. Attached to that identity is a way of being, right? And that completely is at the expense of your natural way of being. If a child is being worshipped in a temple and there's going to be hundreds and thousands of pilgrims coming through every week to worship, the child loses the right to be a child, to be a child per se, and to be a specific child of kind of child that she might be. She might be a really, you know, feisty child. She's not going to get to be that if she's a goddess.
Well, it's essentializing. I think all of us can relate to what that kind of essentialist move is. Anyone who's been told that they're something and they know that they're not, and you want to defend yourself, you get defensive with that. And then when being labeled as a god or sacred, when it shapes your autonomy is kind of completely removed, because you have to do whatever the script is. Whatever the script is what your life becomes.
Precisely. You're reading off a script. You're living off a script. You're being controlled. That's the main thing. You're being controlled by a script. It's a way of domination. It's an act of domination to sacralize a living being in that way. And here we got to ask, what are the stakes in it for the person doing the sacralization? What's the stakes in it for me to sacralize another being? What is the stakes? So here's where we come to identity politics. My identity, let's say as a Hindu, is based on a number of different forms of symbols, identities, rituals, practices, etc. That makes me, let's say, a Hindu, right? But attached to that is also the way that another sentient being is performing their own lives. Okay? So that's no longer politics of identity, that's a politics of identification. So the politics of identification is that I am identifying with, my identity is reliant on a politics of identification with another being, performing, existing, living a certain way. It is not just inherent to the life that I live. It is intricately related to the life that another being lives. I have a stake, my identity. The stakes of my identity is heavily reliant, directly intertwined with the way that another living being lives, whether it's a child, whether it's a woman, whether it's a cow.
So it's not benign, right? If my identity is contingent on identifying someone else as something, then it's no longer benign. It's reliant on a particular set of structures and things to happen. So if my identity as X caste or X position or X whatever is reliant on a particular animal being becoming sacred, then that animal becomes nothing other than that sacred thing, quote unquote, because my identity relies on it.
Exactly. You've distilled the identity. It's the same as commodity production, like Rosemary Collard's work. And, you know, they talk about how commodity production basically means that you reduce an animal to its one use, or to, you know, whatever the uses are. It's that the being of the animal is distilled to the use that you ascribe to the animal. It is the same with sacralization, because that's also a form of commodification, right? So you distilling the animal to being a particular way, which means you have to exercise control. You have a whole spectrum of cows with whole range of personalities. That cannot be allowed. They all have to be distilled to a particular sacred use.
And you use, which I've got to say, I absolutely love the use of this. In having this conversation, you bring up this word de-bovinization, which I think is really super powerful, because whenever we speak, because we do speak about how animals are used to dehumanize particular humans, and it's a really important and powerful and problematic way in which animals are also used in that kind of identification politics that you're talking about. But I think rarely do we talk about how animals are de-whatevered. And here, like de-bovinization, how in this act of making a cow a sacred thing, we deny them, and not just cows, as you mentioned, they're also buffalo. We deny cow and buffalo mothers the opportunity to be bovine in the way they'd like to be.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So dehumanization is not unique to human beings. It is a species. It's a species form. It's a form of species oppression. It's actually a form of desubjectification. You're actually depersonifying and desubjectifying a living being. In the case of humans, you're dehumanizing. In the case of cows, you are debovinizing. And inherently, what that means is that you are erasing the essential characteristics that compose a bovine being as a collective, but also as an individual. Right? As I said, there are multiple differences between cows in terms of their personality, in terms of their notions of a good bovine life. I mean, you know, there are enormous variations within individuals, and also, of course, inherent to the species. So de-bovinization is also as much an oppression of caste in the case of India as dehumanization is. Right. And to make dehumanization, the act of dehumanization somehow unique to humans, is ironically an assertion of human supremacy as well. To say that only humans can be desubjectified in this way, because we desubjectify other animals all the time, and that is sort of fundamental to their exploitation. In any form, whether it is as consumable commodities or whether it is a political objectification and political consumption in that way. Right? So caste has as much of a capacity to de-bovinize, for example, as it does to dehumanize. And that is, but in the case of, the key difference here between dehumanization and de-bovinization is that dehumanization is suffered by humans who are vulnerable politically, socially, historically, etc. Typically, it happens to humans who already have a long entrenched history of vulnerability. In the case of animals, virtually all animals are vulnerable, whether they are seen as elevated or not, because there is not just de-bovinization inherent in the rejection or the contempt that is shown to buffaloes, for example, because they're seen as an indigenous animal, they're seen as a black-skinned animal, and there's a lot of racial contempt that is projected on the buffaloes, in addition to the de-bovinization that occurs naturally as part of being a dairy animal. There is also de-bovinization in the racism and the casteism that is shown to the buffalo, but so too in the ways that in which it is shown to the cow, by elevating a cow supposedly as mother or as goddess, as we have been discussing, there is violence inherent to that process as well.
What made you go with de-bovinization instead of saying de-animalization? Because de-animalization would cut across a whole host of animals. Why choose to, I mean, of course, bovines are not just cows. Bovines include a whole host of animals too. But what made you decide to go with de-bovinization instead of de-animalization?
So I'm happy with when you're talking in much broader terms or in much more generic terms and covering a larger landscape of the non-human world per se, I'm really happy to go with de-animalization. In discussing cows specifically, I thought de-bovinization could help us draw attention to the specific types of elision of bovine vulnerabilities, bovine needs, bovine personhood, bovine biological personhood, as well as political personhood, as it were. In another paper, actually, I talk about depersonization as well, where I talk about the ways in which pigs are also depersonized. So I do extend this into other forms as well. I think we can talk about whatever with a whole spectrum of animals. And I think it is important to sort of not abstract all animals and collapse them, because they all don't share the same vulnerabilities necessarily. There is a de-animalization, I think, that is inherent. It's a form of desubjectification, right? So I think it is pertinent to draw attention to this as a form of political oppression. But I think it can be really helpful to specify as well.
I agree. Because, I mean, as you mentioned there, the cows and buffaloes are kind of positioned in quite different ways in the dairy industry and perhaps in ways that pigs are not, right? And kind of speaking about how those specific practices of dairy maybe disallow particular ways of being, or of being kind of caught up in the pork industry, disallow particular ways of being is quite important. I'd like to speak, because we're already marching on with time, and I don't think we've actually spoken much about cows themselves yet. And I think that we would be remiss if we did not, because we've spoken now about motherhood in a couple of different ways now. So to be a mother, I mean, we've spoken about how the idea of mother is used to mobilize and used against both human mothers and cow mothers. We've spoken about how the idea of being sacred is mobilized in particular ways against cows and mothers, female human mothers. I didn't have the right language. Becoming sacred can actually kind of hinder you. We've spoken about how it's mobilized in national discourses. So mother or mothering or motherhood is a really powerful symbol. I get that. But it's also a material relation. And being these symbols has had really big implications for how cows can be mothered and how you can be mothered in India. So could you maybe just paint us a bit of a picture of what it means to be a cow mother in India, and what does it mean to be mothered by a cow in India?
I think that's a powerful, and that's also a very gutting question as well. To be a cow mother in India is to lose your child instantaneously, to lose the right to suckle, to there is a huge, I mean, let me step back on this a little bit. Biologically speaking, cows that become pregnant in the case of India are already malnourished. They're already severely malnourished. So oftentimes they will have just about enough nutrition to become pregnant in the first place, right? And once they become pregnant, there's a huge amount, a large numbers of cows just losing their infants just in the process of pregnancy as well. It's a process called dystochia, where they cannot even deliver easily. They cannot even deliver easily because they're so weak. They're so malnourished. And there's a history of malnourishment, which means they often give birth to very, very malnourished calves. They give birth to calves that are way, way lighter than they should be at birth, right? So there is an enormous, you know, practice of malnutrition, undernutrition, and leading to high rates of maternal mortality and infant mortality by itself, even before they reach the slaughterhouse. So we kind of really need to be attentive to that. And this is not very different at all from the high rates of maternal mortality and infant mortality that is more prevalent amongst humans in India as well. I think it's one of the leading countries for maternal mortality and child mortality generally. It's the practices of dairying per se are consistent, I think, in India as there are elsewhere. The child is separated from the mother virtually instantaneously. What happens is around the difference, right? So the girl calf generally gets fed, you know, formula. What happens to the male? What happens in other countries is that they will also get shunted off to the slaughterhouse. What happens in India, it's a very, very normative, very widespread practice, is to simply starve the calf to death. The male calf is quite literally starved to death. But it's not, you know, so these processes are pervasive. But what actually really is one of the most viscerally haunting memories is actually when the calf and the cow are still present in the farm, either when the calves haven't been shunted off to the slaughterhouse yet, or they haven't been starved yet, or if there are still female calves that are used. Now, it's interesting, what the practice that actually happens in India is that oftentimes the calves are still used as cogs of the dairy industry, because there is a lot of crossbreeding between native Indian cows and the Holsteins and Jerseys that are imported from usually the United States and other European countries, etc. Now, the native Indian cow, apparently, and this is something I keep hearing over and over, buffalo mothers as well, is something I keep hearing over and over, is that they don't actually allow milk let down unless the calf is nearby, because they perform milk let down, so to speak, only when the calf is nearby, because they haven't been bred as intensively for the dairy industry. They still have some of the natural indigenous wildness, as it were, which keeps them less commodifiable in some ways, right? So the Holstein cow, for example, apparently will just let down milk more easily as compared to the indigenous cows. Now, when the indigenous cows are crossbred, they still retain some of the indigeneity in not being able to letting down their milk unless the calf is present. So oftentimes you'll still see the calf being used as a cog of the dairy industry in India. So they will be allowed literally to suckle for maybe 10 seconds. So allow milk let down and then they'll be pulled away. That moment happens over and over and over in India. That moment of separation happens over and over and over. It's not a once-off, that as it happens normatively in Western farms. This happens twice a day.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it is quite emotional. And the scenes you paint in your book, there was one farm I know you visited where you asked them to just please let the calf suckle. You said, please just let them, and you know, I found it, you're so brave. You're in all of these places and the amount of times you ask or you're in, and it's hard, I guess, like when you're doing this research, you're told not to intervene, you're told not to do these things, but when it's just such a visceral moment, but there was the story about the calf that you asked, please let them feed. And they went and they fed for 23 minutes, right?
Yes, they fed for about 27 minutes, correct. And it was a revelation for all of us as a collective. I mean, I was just a researcher with no history of handling cows or knowing anything about cows. I'd never lived with cows. So this was a time when I visited a number of dairy farms, but this was a dairy farm that I visited at the time of milking. And they were using this calf as a cog. And, you know, the calves were being taken to different cows and then, you know, pulled away after 10 seconds. And it's actually an extremely loud time, not just for the ways that the mothers bellow, but for the ways that the calves bellow. Okay. A calf has an exceptionally loud sound. And I think it's because in a natural herd, let's say in the forest, if a calf gets lost or falls away, the calf needs to be able to cry really loudly in order for the mother to come back and find him again, right? So it's actually an exceptionally loud, you have to pay attention. And in that moment of hyper-stress and anxiety, because the cows are hyper-stressed and anxious, certainly I was feeling it as a researcher who was very empathetic to their cause. It's also likely that the workers were, because how can you not be affected by that? But so, you know, they were constantly pulling the calves, and I said, oh, please just, but there was this one calf who was being punished because he was a very spirited calf and he was the last to get suckled. And I said, please just, it was breaking my heart, a male calf. I knew he, and he was exceptionally loud. And, you know, those big bovine eyes, and you can just see those. I mean, it's a baby. It's an actual baby, you know? And so I said, please just let him feed. So they did. And actually, they were really kind, either, I think, probably in some ways more to me than necessarily to the calf. But then they let the calf feed, and they kept saying, do you want me to pull the calf away? I said, no, let him have one decent feed. So we let the calf have one decent feed. It took 27 minutes. It was only remarkable because how quickly calves are pulled away. Because it's also, because, you know, they're used as cogs of the dairy industry, and because the calves are allowed to suckle at least twice a day, so to speak, you know, the claim can be made, right? They only do it for 10 seconds or 15 seconds, but the claim can be made that, hey, we let the calf suckle. The claim can be made in Indian dairying like that. So, but the 10, 15 second suckling therefore becomes normative. You do anything repetitively, it becomes normative, right? So when you allow a calf to suckle for 27 minutes and they're suckling and suckling and suckling, and it was a revelation for all of us. All of us, we actually gathered to watch this wondrous act, because it was a wondrous act. These were all people who were working in the dairy farm. They had seen calves suckle all the time. It was the amount of time, right? We were all watching as though it was a wondrous act, because it was the simple act of suckling. And for a very loud spirited calf, he was very mellow, very calm, and they pulled him back. But it was just unbearable, because the thing is, we know that even with human infants, suckling usually happens every 2 hours, feeding happens every 2 hours. And this is something that is chronically denied. They live in a state of chronic hunger.
And it's not just the milk, right? Like, we tend to think when it comes to dairy cows, you know, there are some, or dairy animals, I think in general, there are some tropes that kind of come up time and again, and because they matter and they're important. The extent to which calves are taken away from their mothers, the limited time in which they are able to suckle. But there are so many other ways in which they are denied meaningful relations. The number of just calves lying on concrete floors or tied to these really small tethers, being unable to to move or even to touch another. That just seems like a whole, the lack of touch just seemed really cruel.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think there is enough research that's been done in the case of humans about how lack of touch during infancy or childhood for various reasons leads to all forms of really intense, long-lasting, enduring trauma. In the case of cows, we also have to understand, I think this is possibly very inherent to, you know, human mothering as well. I think we would all be tribal mothers if social formations allowed that. We have become increasingly atomized as a society. But certainly in the case of bovine mothering, I think tribal mothering is somehow also very inherent. Whether it comes to, I think there is very much a unique bond between a biological mother and a biological calf, but tribal mothering is an important part of bovine mothering per se, right? So the number of times that I have seen a cow try to get to a calf that is not even hers, and there is an ache there. There's an ache there too. There's a separation there too. There are so many layers of separation and trauma that we don't actually even identify, because we focus on the main one, which is the one that we can possibly resonate the most with. Tribal mothering is not something that is normative in human systems anymore. So we tend to disregard that, the importance and the value of that, right? But it is such a huge part of bovine mothering. And the number of times that I've seen cows, of course, they're intensively tired. They cannot, but they try to get to calves who are not even theirs. And that urge is strong. That urge is powerful. And therefore, the inability to fulfill that urge would be really traumatic, would be, you know, full of heartbreak for the cow and the calf.
Yeah. And the places where this is all happening are also really quite varied. So the extent to which the separation is happening, you know, I think maybe some of us have in our minds, when you see, you know, these mega dairies kind of emerging with those huge rotational dairy systems. But this isn't like, as you said, you've now got kind of calves being used to prime like milk flow and all of this. But you've got mini dairies happening in the middle of cities where there's massive amounts of noise. And also, how do you say goshalas? Is that how you say it?
Goshalas, yeah.
Goshalas. Yeah, anyway, like just the numerous spaces in which this kind of separation is happening and the proximity to calves that are not your own is happening as well is quite remarkable. Okay, Yamini, before I give away all the details in your books, I just one last question before we go to your quote is, this was clearly a remarkable amount of ethnographic research here. You spent a lot of time. How long did it take you to do this? And how did you do this? How did you get into these spaces and you know, getting access to dairy industries and stuff in North America is near impossible, but you've managed to kind of go into a variety of spaces from a variety of angles. You spoke to animal rights activists, you spoke to farmers, you spoke to people who sacralize the cow, but you spoke to people who don't. You spoke to truckers. You spoke to, you know, conservationists. You really did an immense amount of work. So perhaps we could just speak a little bit about that. Like, how did you do this?
I think a few things went in my favor in terms of access. One is, I think the animal industry in India is nowhere as severely securitized the way it is in the West. So I think access was much easier, though now with animal rights activism as well as Hindu vigilantism, both of them on the rise, I think it is becoming a little bit harder. But at the time that I started, I think I had the fortune of these spaces just not being as securitized as they are in the West. So I think in the West, it's virtually impossible to get in unless you have a lot of contacts, unless they are very assured that you're not going to be critical or political. That wasn't necessarily the case. The other thing that helped was actually being a social scientist in some of these spaces which are very professionally, you know, pure sciences like genetic engineering, for example. There is a certain ease in being ignorant, because as a social scientist, I know nothing about genetic science. I know nothing about a lot of things. So to go there feeling very free to be ignorant was actually also very liberating. So I was able to, you know, let go of my own sort of inhibitions and just ask questions freely, note freely, ask very obvious and mundane questions, which I think is also part of ethnography. Because when I go to a particular site, I'm not just going there by myself. I'm actually going with interpreters of that site who might be dairy scientists, who might be genetic scientists, who might be cow vigilantes, who might be, you know, right-wing fascists. They could be a spectrum of people, but they are interpreting the site for me because they are engaging with the site in the ways that I'm not. So I think losing your inhibition is really crucial in ethnography, your own inhibition to be ignorant and to ask questions. The other thing that possibly helped me was my Brahmin status, because a lot of the Hindu right, and especially those that owned gaushalas, these are cow shelters that are very political spaces, they assumed that I am inherently sympathetic to the cause of the Hindu right. They couldn't have necessarily foreseen that my politics was going to be really critical in terms of both caste, but also critical animal politics. The dovetailing of that would actually completely overturn or challenge or be in contrast to their own politics. And they wouldn't have necessarily seen that. And so my Brahmin status gave me access because they just thought, of course you're sympathetic and of course you are invested in cow protection. Like, why wouldn't I be? And sure, I am invested in cow protection, but my interpretations of cow protection are very different to a political interpretation, to a Hindu political interpretation of cow protection.
This actually takes us back to the first question, which I don't think we answered, is what was the difference between cow protection and animal rights? I think we started there, and I don't know, did we say what the difference is between cow protection and animal rights or animal activism?
I think it's a good place to circle back, because cow protection is a Hindu, is an advocacy strategy to create and protect a Hindu state. It is very different from any form of animal activism, because it is not in the interest of the animal, it's in the interest of a Hindu state.
Okay, there we go. Said clearly. Well, I mean, it's been incredible. I know is there anything with related to mother that you think that we haven't quite got to that you would like to say before we move to the quote?
I think we covered everything, but what I wish I had done I think I'll answer this question in terms of what I wish I had done in my own research looking back, right? Like, you think you've spent the last, I don't know, 5-6 years on this research and you have hopefully covered all aspects of it, and there's always something that remains. And what I wish I had paid more attention to, and I hope that this might be something that future researchers on cows might potentially pay more attention to, is focus more on the cow, on the calf. Because I think I did the thing that a lot of cow research does, and understandably so, which is to overwhelmingly focus on the traumas of the cow. But there's also a lot to be said about the traumas of the calf, and that is very much it's an incomplete picture of motherhood if we don't actually understand fully what's going on with the calf. And I wish I'd paid more attention to that. So maybe future ethnography can actually pay more attention and tell us more about what happens and help us read the calf better.
Yeah, it's like the calf is often forgotten. Sometimes I didn't get that sense from reading it that you forgot about the calf, but I understand how we sometimes treat species as a monolithic group. And I mean, I think throughout your work, you showed kind of species is insufficient, even though it's important to kind of use to understand how we've got particular vulnerabilities. The experiences of a Jersey cow is very different to the experience of an indigenous cow, is very different to the experience of a buffalo cow, is very different to a steer and a bull and a calf. And even then, a calf born into an urban dairy is quite different to a calf born, you know, in a rural forest. They cut through with their own experiences.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What you just said reminds me in terms of being specific. I would hope that future research might consider being more specific with regards to the experiences of the girl calf, because we all focus on the male calf, rightly so, because their separation is visceral, total, and they shunted off to the slaughterhouse. But there's a lot to be learned about the ongoing traumas of separation from the girl calf. From the experiences of the girl calf. And I think that's something that needs to be really deepened in dairy research. So I was hoping that maybe future research could do what I think I didn't pay enough attention to in my own work.
Well, thank you so much for everything you have done. Do you have a quote ready?
Yeah, I thought I might read just a short paragraph from my chapter on milking, and that was the scenario that you alluded to earlier in our conversation about my visiting a dairy farm where I pleaded for the calf to be fed a full meal. But as I was leaving that farm, there was also a cow who was imminently giving birth. So I just want to read out just the very last section, the very last short, very short section of, you know, how that end transpired, right? So I'm reading here. "She's about to give birth, first time," said the owner, who was kneeling and closely observing her udders, even as I looked at her wide eyes, fearful and in pain. "Less than 45 minutes now," I would say. "You can stay and watch if you like," added the man. I paused. "How quickly will you remove the calf?" I asked. "Immediately," the man nodded. "We'll give her a few minutes to clean and then immediately remove. One of the workers will give the calf its first feed from a bottle." "Not even the first feed from the mother?" I asked. "No," he replied. "We encourage no relationship between the mother and the child." I thanked the owner and I quickly walked out. As we left the gate, I noticed something I had not seen earlier in that evening, but which is a common sight in most dairies and gaushalas in India. A tall statue of the blue-skinned Lord Krishna, playing a flute as he leaned against a beautiful white cow. Then, as now, her calf was nowhere to be seen. She was frozen in time in her role as a mother, solely to the human.
Amazing. I think that really does sum up a lot of what we've spoken about here today.
Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you, Claudia. I enjoyed it so much. And I think this is one of my favorite interviews that I have ever done. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
You're too good. Like you bend my mind. Like I'm sitting here and I'm supposed to be coming up with questions to ask you, but now I'm like, my mind is whirring with things to say and to do. I know that you've switched gears a little bit. You've switched gears, but you're still doing research in India at the moment, right? But what are you doing research on now?
So currently I have switched gears and I will at some point, I'm sure, return to dairy farming and bovine ethnography at some point. But currently I'm actually working on another large industry, which is virtually unrecorded or unspoken about in animal studies more broadly, which is the bricklands of India, the large construction sectors of India, which what I've learned very quickly in my research is that there's not one innocent brick in South Asia per se. South Asia has the largest brick belt, which goes from Afghanistan, Pakistan, India into Bangladesh and Nepal. So I'm focusing on the bricklands in India, which is notorious for human rights and child rights abuses. But it's also really notorious for some of the most brutal exploitations of equid labor, donkeys, horses, mules, and also camels and ox. So there's a lot of. So I'm basically focusing on animal labor in Indian bricklands and bringing a new materiality, which is bricks, sand, topsoil, into conversation, because a lot of the materialities that we discuss in animal studies often is the materiality directly sourced from their bodies, like milk, meat, which is, of course, some of the most significant forms of animal commodification, but also the ways in which sand, topsoil, bricks rely on value being added by animal labor is something that I'm trying to bring into focus as well.
And what you do so powerfully is bring these intersections together, you know, showing how animal labor is shot through with particular types of human labor and that we can't speak about them as separate from one another. It's not sensible to actually be speaking about them as though they exist in isolation from other forms of oppression or other kind of challenges. So are you heading to the field to do that soon?
Yes, so I'm heading to India in 2 weeks for another 2 weeks. I've already spent about 3 months in India. So I'm going to go back. The reason I'm going back in May is because that is the end of the bricklands season. So the brick baking season, like dairy farming, occurs all through the year. Brick making occurs they have to stop before the monsoons because, you know, they can't mold the brick because of the rains, and they also can't turn the oven on, right? The huge ovens. So it has to, by the end of summer, the bricklands have to close before the monsoons start. So it is about 45 degrees Celsius, which I think is close to 100 degrees Fahrenheit weather-wise. And then the ovens themselves are radiating about 600 degrees Celsius of heat. The animals have been working in extraordinarily hot conditions, carrying huge amounts of labor, huge amounts of weight for several months now. And so far, I've always seen the animals at the start of the bricklaying season. in northern winter. So now I want to go in northern summer because they are absolutely decrepit by this time. They are living corpses, really, by this time, emaciated with the kind of work that they've been doing. So the International Labour Organization actually calls the Bricklands the most extreme working environment. And they are, of course, talking about human beings because that's what ILO does, right? They are focused on human labor and human labor violations. But if you can imagine, if it is the most extreme working environment, you can imagine what that also means for animals who are subsidizing the most extreme working environment. Yeah.
This is heavy stuff, Yamini. This is heavy, heavy stuff. It's remarkable and it's interesting, and you're incredibly inspiring to do. These are difficult topics that we need to talk about and that people need to go to and see and write about frankly and honestly, which is not easy to do when you're looking at animals in situations where humans are also treated badly, right? It's really hard to speak about animals being treated badly in situations where humans are also being treated badly because...
And they're being treated badly by humans who are being treated badly. So to navigate that landscape of extreme human vulnerability that is nonetheless also causing extreme human animal vulnerability is a very fraught landscape to walk carefully. So these are the landmines that I'm navigating at the moment.
Well, you're teaching us all. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your energy, your efforts, the research. I'll make sure that I put your details of your website and social media in the show notes. But thank you so much for joining me on the Animal Turn, Yamini.
Oh, thank you, Claudia, for the most wonderful conversation I've had. I genuinely mean it. I think this is the conversation about the book that I've enjoyed the most so far. So thank you. Thank you for your time. And thank you for having me over again
for
at the
second
Animal Turn.
Time.
It's a real honor. It's a real honor. Thank you.
Thank you so much to Yamini Narayanan for being an amazing guest, to Christian Mentz for editing this episode, to Jeremy John for the logo, and Gordon Clark for the bird music. As always, thank you to Animals and Philosophy, Politics, Law and Ethics, Apple, for sponsoring this podcast. This is The Animal Turn with me, Claudia Hertenfelder.
For more great iRaw podcasts, visit iRawPod.com. That's IROARPOD.com.